Hi, everybody. My name is Hank Johnson. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Hank.
And it's great to be here this morning. And I'm talking to some of the people at the table. They've been getting up at 4:30 in the morning to come down here. Boy, that is going to any length. That's past any length. And it's good to see my friend Bill, who I've known for a few years, and I heard Bonnie speak last night. She was great, and up until right now, this has been a wonderful weekend. I used to drink a lot. I thought I'd better throw that in. In case you thought I was some kind of an imposter or something. I know I don't look like an alcoholic. I'm only 39 years old. My son says I'm just a basic fifth of vodka a day drinker. You know. But what does he know? He only saw me around the house every night. Yeah, I did a lot of social drinking during the day. And I used to like to drink. I went into a bar when I was 18 years old in California. It's supposed to be 21 to get a drink. I passed for 21. And the guy served me a drink. And immediately, I became a man. That's what I wanted to be, a man. And a man can buy a drink over a bar without being asked how old he is. I had done a little behind the gym drinking before that. But this is big time drinking, you know, when you go into a bar and order one. I felt at home there. You know, sometimes I hear people say they came into the AA and their very first meeting, they walked in and they just felt like they came home, you know. God, I didn't feel that way at all. But I sure felt that way at that bar. I tell you, I was at home. I felt great, you know. And I was comfortable there, and I could play the jukebox over in the corner just as good as the rest of the guys. In fact, I thought my selection of songs were a little better than most. And I could sit there at the bar and look myself in the mirror and get better looking after each drink. And from that moment on, I drank on a regular basis. From that moment on, booze was the focal point of my life. And, you know, I thought I became a man when I got that drink. And actually what happened is my emotional growth stopped right then and there, and I dealt with the next 30 years with an 18-year-old set of emotions. And, you know, that's okay when you're 18. It's okay when you're in your 20s, you can get by with that. But after you get in your 30s and 40s and you're still reacting to things, you know, like you're 18, they start looking at you funny. And but that's what I did, and I realized that. And so I... My sobriety date is December the 29th, 1969, and a little over 26 years of sobriety. And, you know, they had your raffle here today. My sponsor is Clancy, and we were at a conference one time, and they said, now, the next thing we're going to raffle off is a tape from Hank J. You know, Clancy had a whole bunch of tickets. He just tore them up. You know, I need a sponsor like that. I get to thinking I know something, you know, and I really don't, and I'm really no big deal, and I'm really grateful to be asked to come here and share this morning. I got married, and I met my wife in a bar. Where else do you meet girls, you know? And we got married and moved out to a little shack, a little garage, or little track house, I'm trying to say, and the payments were $56 a month. That included interest and taxes and everything. No down payment, of course, you know. And you know, I had trouble making those payments. Those payments would come due on the first of the month, and I used my money for booze, and I couldn't come up with the payments. And so I figured, well, I'll double up next month. I won't make a payment this month. Next month, I'll pay two payments. You know. And next month, it'd come along. God, I'd have to come up with $112 plus late charge. How am I going to do that? You know, and I'd have to stiff all my other creditors and somehow make the payment. And we almost lost that house, I don't know, 100 times. And we finally we sold it and moved in with my father for free. And if anybody would have asked me, Hank, what is your problem? I would have said, money. Money is my problem, you know. If I don't know how I got involved in this work I do, it just doesn't pay enough. And if she'd only go to work, help out a little bit, you know. But, you know, no. Turns out she was pregnant. She already had a baby by a previous marriage, and her number two is going to come, and I didn't start saving for that baby until about a week before it was due. So I went to the beneficial finance company and borrowed the money to pay the hospital and medical expenses when my son was born. When I finally got sober in AA, my son turned 25, I finally got beneficial paid off. I don't know about you, but, you know, I always had a crisis in my life. Every time I'd almost get those guys paid off, something would happen, and I'd have to go back and refinance, you know, and reconsolidate my bills, and I never got enough. You know, I never did figure it out right. And besides, something would happen to part of that money on the way home, and I tried to pay off all my bills, you know, and it wasn't enough, so then I have to go to the Pacific Finance Company and borrow more, and geez, this is the way I lived, you know. I'm glad I don't have to do that anymore. But my drunkologue has got to be the most boring story you've ever heard. Last night I heard Bonnie's story. My God, I wish I could have done some of the stuff that she. You hear such exciting stories. Sometimes from these podiums, my God, you know, guys. You know, I have one guy I heard talk. He used to go in a bar, he'd punch everybody out in a bar. The cops would come, he'd punch the cops out too. He'd get drug off to jail and thrown into a cell. Walk over to the bunk he wanted, pull the guy out of the bunk and punch him out too. You know? My boy, really, he man Draker. You know? God, I admire that guy. You know? Okay. Another guy used to drive and hit telephone poles all the time, only they were 100 yards off the highway. And he'd come out of a blackout wrapped around a telephone pole. You know, that's exciting drinking. He'd drive through a tunnel 60 miles an hour and decide to make a U-turn right now. You know, all that kind of stuff. But the best one I've ever heard is this guy was a jet pilot. And he came out of a blackout after a two-week drunk, going faster than the speed of sound at 20,000 feet. Now, man, that is class He-Man drinking. And all I ever did is just sat around and drank. I meant to do some of that stuff. I just never got around to it, that's all. I used to watch a lot of TV, play a lot of old phonograph records. Sometimes I'd read a book, nothing very heavy, just some condensed version in the Reader's Digest. And I just kind of let the world go by, you know. I'm just kind of an observer of life. You know, I don't participate in it, I just watch you guys do it. And criticize the way you do it. I could do it hell of a lot better than you could, if I felt like, you know. And that's the way I lived. And after, I don't know how many years, my son was about 16 years old, and our daughter had already split, and my wife and I got divorced for the third time. And I moved into a little shack in Hermosa Beach, California. The whole apartment wasn't very but a little bit bigger than this stage up here. It was in a garage. It was an old garage that they had made some living quarters in. And it was a room about 12 by 15 or something. I bought a turntable and 10 speakers from a friend of mine. And a typical day for me was that I would get up at 10 o'clock in the morning, you know, wake up, you know, come to, Jesus, 10 o'clock, I'm already an hour late to work. Oh, man, I'd throw my clothes on, get in that car, weave in and out of traffic. I had to get there. See, I should have worked yesterday. You know, I left all those papers all over my desk. I had papers in my desk drawer. Some of them are months old. They were too old to turn in. If I turned them in, I'd get fired for holding them so long. If I didn't turn them in, I was going to get fired. You know, and I knew today was the day. This is the last day of working for that company. I knew it. I knew when I got there, I was going to be fired. And you see, that was my last little bit of respectability. I had drank my wife away, my kids away, my home away. I drank everything away except my job. And I worked for a big company, and they put my name on one of their business cards. That's who I was. And if they fired me, I'd be nothing. Zero, you know. And I was afraid I was going to lose my job. And I'd get to work, and I'd check everything out. Everything appeared to be the same. I'd go to the coffee room, get a cup of coffee, and come back to my desk and shuffle papers and make excuses to my customers and try to look interested, you know. At a respectable time, I'd go to the bar that was conveniently located right next door to where I worked and have lunch. And they sold martinis over there. And I liked martinis. And during the lunch hour, they sold double martinis for a dollar. The regular martinis were 75 cents. And I figured, you know, whoever heard of having one martini? You're going to have two anyhow, so you might as well order the dollar one. You'll save 50 cents. God knows you need the money bad. And I'd order the dollar one. And I'd sit there at the bar, and I'd kind of checking my drink against the guy sitting next to me. He'd have a 75 center. And I'd say to myself, who in the hell do they think they're kidding around here? This isn't a double. It's a little larger than the regular one, that's all. Not really a double. If it were really a double, they'd be charging more money. I've been around. I know these things, you know. So I better have another one. And then I'd have another one. And then I'd have another one. And then I'd have another one. Then I'd call the office. It was only next door. I could have hollered over there. But I always called because I got a lot of class, you know. And call on telephone. Done. I forgot to tell you. I'm going on a lot of calls this afternoon. Take messages. I'll be back tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. And I'd head towards the beach. It'd be like 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I'd stop and buy the cheapest bottle of vodka I could find. Whatever was on sale that day, that's what I bought. I'd get home about 2 or 2:30 in the afternoon. And I'm kind of a neat drunk. I'd hang up my clothes real carefully, put my shirt and tie away and my shoes and everything, put my pajamas on. And it's 2:30 in the afternoon. I'd untap that cheap vodka, take a big, big jolt out of it, you know, several swallows. And I'd put one of those old 78s on the turntable. Something like Billy Eckstein singing, "Who Can I Turn To?" And then I'd go into my fantasy about starting tomorrow. It's all going to be different. Starting tomorrow, by God, I'm going to get up at 6 o'clock. I'm going to get down to that damn office by 7. I'll knock out paperwork for a couple hours. When that phone starts ringing tomorrow, I'm going to be ready to do business. And starting tomorrow, a whole new life is going to open up for me. You know, I'm not even going to drink starting tomorrow. In fact, I'm going to put a big red X on the calendar, and starting tomorrow, I'm going to work 365 days in a row. You know, I'm in sales. I can work any hours I want to work. And Starting tomorrow, I'm going to work 365 days in a row, and every waking moment, I'm going to be earning money. And, I'm going to take a year out of my life. And I can't do anything about that marriage, but at least I can get squared away financially once and for all. Jeez, what a terrific idea. You know, sometimes I just amaze myself. I come up with these wonderful ideas. And I get to thinking, I could just see myself 365 days from now. I could just see the end of that drudgery, and that I'd be completely out of debt, have a brand new car, paid for, and I'd be really set up great financially, and it would just seem real. I could just see how good I was going to feel in 365 days. So much that I just started celebrating a job well done. What am I going to do with all that money? One of the things I'm going to do is I'm going to buy a white Lincoln Continental car. This dates me, but that was the great car back in 69. it still is. But I'll buy a white Lincoln Continental. I'll drive it up to that house where she still lives. And I'll stop at the Hallmark card shop, and I'll buy a beautiful sentimental card, and I'll put there on it, write down, "Thanks for all the good years, H." Not Henry, not Hank, just H. And then I'd get a gold-plated key and put it in with that envelope. And I'd drive to that house at midnight or 1 a.m. and drive down that street and hang a U-turn in the cul-de-sac and coast up in front of the house and be real quiet, tiptoe up on the steps and put that envelope with the key down the mail slot. Then I'd split. Next morning, she'll get up and she'll go through her routine and she'll go to get the mail. She'll look and she'll see that envelope, no stamp on it, She'll wonder what that is. So she'll open that one first. And key will drop out. Wonder what the key is, Then she'll read that card with that sentimental poetry and that sticky sentimental poetry. And she'll read that and tears will just roll down her cheeks. It'll just be excruciatingly painful for her, And then she'll look at that key and she'll kind of try to figure out. And then somehow she'll look out the front of the house. See that white Lincoln Continental out there, brand new, shiny, beautiful. And she'll put it all together that's her car. Then she'll be sorry, by God. I don't know about you guys, but I just love to buy those expensive gifts. And by now, I'm really feeling great. I know everything's going to be okay starting tomorrow. It's just going to be wonderful, And I look up at the clock, and it's 10:45. It can't be that late. That's wrong. It can't be 10:45. It just can't be. I just sat down here on the edge of this bed, and I'd call the operator and check. 10:45. Jesus, where's the day gone? I can't believe it, Then I'd realize I was almost out of booze, and the liquor store closed at 11. I'd throw my clothes on over my pajamas, and I'd run 2 blocks to the liquor store. I had to get there before they closed. That's when I first started jogging, about that time. I'd get there just as they were closing up. Bottle of Smirnoff's. I always bought the better brands right around where I lived. I wouldn't want anybody to think I was cheap right there in the neighborhood, Then I could stroll back to my shack with peace and contentment and security for the rest of the night. And I'd go back there and play a few more of those old records and reminisce about the good old days that really weren't all that good. And play those songs and sit there and drink. Then I get to thinking, what I ought to do? I ought to work 2 years in a row. At the end of 2 years, I have so much money. You know, I'll just take a whole year off. I'll buy a boat, and I'll sail all over the world. I've been everywhere in the world, all in every port, in every place in the world, sitting on the edge of my bed. And I started rehearsing the speech I was going to have to give, because I knew I was going to be salesman of the year. And somewhere in there, I'd pass out. And the next morning, I'd wake up, it'd be 10 o'clock. Murray and I were late to work. Oh, man. I'd get in that car, weaving it out. I had to get there. I should have worked yesterday. I left all those papers. I knew I'd be fired. I'd get to work, check everything. Everything the same. And at a respectable time, I'd go to lunch at the bar that was conveniently located right next door to where I worked. I'd go over there and make my big decision of the day, whether to have the dollar one or the 75-center. And then I'd have another one, then I'd have another one, then I'd have another one. And then I'd call and tell them, I forgot to tell you, I'm going a lot of calls, take messages. I'll be back tomorrow morning at 9. I'd head towards the beach and stop and buy a bottle of vodka, get home and put my pajamas on and sit on the edge of the bed and untap that cheap vodka, take a big, big jolt out of it, you know, several swallows full, and I'd put one of those old records on the turntable. Something like Billy Eckstein singing, "Who Can I Turn To?" And then I'd say to myself, well, you've done it again today. You know, this cannot continue. You're not the only guy that's ever been divorced. You're not the only guy that's ever been in debt. Why the hell don't you do something about it? You just sit around and talk about stuff. You never take any action on anything. Then I'd have this wonderful, bright idea. Starting tomorrow, it's all going to be different. Starting tomorrow, a whole new life is going to open up for me. Starting tomorrow, I'm going to work 365 days in a row. I'm going to put a big red X on the calendar, and I'm going to work, and I'm going to make money. I can devote 1 year out of my life to play catch-up. A lot of people do stuff like that. I'm going to do it starting tomorrow. And, you know, I didn't do that once or twice. I did that hundreds of times. Sometimes a boss would ask me, he says, "You in sales here?" And I'd say, "Yeah, I'm in sales. Well, how about making a sale?" I'd say, "Don't worry about a thing. I'm a fast finisher." And I was. You know, he'd scare me. It wasn't really the money I was working for. I just didn't want to lose that job. My last bit of prestige, my last bit of... And so I really would work around the clock then. And somehow, for 8 drunken years in a row, I was in the top 10% of my company in sales. I don't know how the hell I did that. But every year, they give me a plaque, you know, with my name on it. Outstanding salesmanship and product knowledge and being the type of representative we want to represent this company and all that good stuff all over the plaque for 8 drunken years in a row. Then I got sober. And then I didn't win a plaque for 8 years. See, what happened to me when I got sober, I lost my fear. You know, I was no longer afraid. So I lose my job, I get another one, you know. And I just wasn't afraid. And so I didn't win a plaque for 8 years. And then I got, when I was up, my wife made a suicide attempt. Back up here a little bit. Through a series of bad breaks and misunderstanding, my wife and son moved in with me. And we're going to try it one more time. And little did I know that during that 2 or 3 year period that we were apart, she had started to drink. And she was a bad drinker. Kind of like Bonnie. Kind of a bad drinker. But she was a mean drunk. She said, "Well, we're going to move in back in together. We'll sell that house. We'll make a little money, pay some bills off, and we'll make a fresh start," and all this stuff, you know. And she said, "I won't even fight you on your drinking. In fact, I'll join you." And little did I know that she had, you know, had already became an alcoholic. She had started to drink. And some of us, the first time we drink, we get in trouble. The very first time we drink, we just get in all kinds of problems. You know, get arrested or have wrecks, whatever, you know. And and that's the way she was. Now, I used to say I didn't become an alcoholic until about 20 years into my drinking. That's not true. I became an alcoholic when I first drank. But I didn't get in any trouble. You know, I was just one of the... You can't get in much trouble sitting on the edge of your bed drinking. And you don't get many drunk driving arrests for that. And so I didn't get any trouble. But she got in all kinds of problems, had all kinds of problems when she drank. And she was a very outgoing, friendly person when she was sober. And people knew her and liked her. And she was very friendly, like at the supermarket. She knew all the checkout girls and all that. And how many, and then whether they were married, how many kids they had, and all that. I don't know how she did all that, you know. But anyway, very friendly. But you give her one drink, and all the pent-up emotions and hostilities of a lifetime would come out in that first drink as she was blacking out. And she had no capacity for the stuff at all, and she was just it was just no fun drinking with her at all, that's all. And I'm not here to take her inventory, but I think I'll tell you just a few of the things that she did. It'll help you understand me and my problem. But she took the Christmas tree lights and all and threw them out the back door. She'd break my old 78 records and just because I played them more than once. I don't know about you people, but sometimes I like music when I drink, and so I put one of those old records on, some record I hadn't heard for 20 years or something, you know. Put it on, my God, that's a good song. I'd play it again. And I'd play it one more time. And then again, and again, and again. Used to drive her crazy. And she'd walk over to the phonograph and take the record off the turntable. Don't break that record. That's a collector's item, you know. Bang, oh. And one time, sometimes too, I don't know if there's any music lovers out there or not, but I'd hear a particular note on a record, and I'd get the needle, and I'd lay it in there, you know. It's a trumpet toot, you know. Toot! Oh, man, that is really good. Get the needle and put it in there again. Toot! Oh, geez. Do it again, yeah. She walked over the phonograph one night, and just took the arm of it and just bent it up. I couldn't play any more records that night, I'll tell you that. And, and that's the way we lived. Only it was a lot worse than that. And one time she made a suicide attempt. I had gone and stayed with my brother. And I had told her, this isn't working at all. We should have never gotten back together again. Just, you know, it's a bad deal. I allowed you to kick me out of all those other houses we lived in. But I moved here first, therefore you go this time. And I'm going to stay at my brother's house tonight. When I come back, I expect you to be out of here. And so that night, while I was gone, she decided to commit suicide, which was no big deal. She was always doing that. She was always committing suicide and making suicide attempts, you know. One time after she got sober in AA, she had about 8 months or something of sobriety in AA, and she was at work, and things were going bad for her, and she decided, well, when I come home tonight, I'm going to commit suicide. She had 8 months of sobriety, and she got home, and she realized she couldn't commit suicide that night because she was the cookie lady at the meeting that night. Sometimes you wonder, you know, why they give some of us flaky people some of the jobs they give us around here. They're life-saving jobs, that's why. You know, they actually save your life. Her sponsor finally got to her and said, you know, you got to knock this stuff off. You know, one of these days you're going to hurt yourself real bad. You know? But that night, before she... going to do it, she went into the closet where my clothes were hanging, and I just took a knife and slashed every stitch of clothes I owned, just ripped everything to pieces, cut my ties in half and cut the pant legs off my pants and slashed my coats and sweaters and shirts and stabbed my shoes even. And I just made a complete... You know, and then he went out in the living room and she broke all those records and pulled the pictures off the wall and smashed them and broke the lamps and pulled the drapes off the wall and just completely destroyed this little place that we lived in. And then she went, turned the gas on, the kitchen oven, and went to bed. Next morning, she woke up. Failed again, you know. And she looked around, and she had been the only one that stayed there that night. She knew she had done it, but she didn't remember doing it. She did all that in a complete blackout. So, you know, she just couldn't believe that she had done that. Then I got home about 9 o'clock the next morning. And I looked around. I had trouble believing it myself. And we hit bottom. That was our bottom, you know. Not a very dramatic thing, I guess. I don't know. Dramatic enough for us. You know, when we got married, we had wonderful plans what we were going to do with our life. You know, we planned to live the good life. That was our plan. And all we had managed to do is just sit around and drink every bit of goodness out of our lives. And from then on, nothing was good. From then on, everything was bad. I didn't quit drinking. Sometimes you hear, this is the type of time in the story where the speaker will say, oh, and I hit bottom, and so I called AA, and some real nice guy came over and took me to a meeting, and everything just been wonderful ever since. I didn't know enough to call AA, you know. I just kept on drinking. But it wasn't any good anymore. And we had been going to therapy. We went to group therapy, private therapy, all kinds of, you know, psychiatrists and psychologists and counselors and all kinds of stuff like that we had done, over a period of years. We just didn't know what to do. This therapist asked me, do you really drink as much as she says? You know, I said, hell yeah, I do. I drink a lot. Who wouldn't? You know. I've not only got her to contend with, I got two of the worst kids you could possibly imagine. A pressure job. So I drink. I'm not causing any trouble for anybody. You know, I may be hurting my own health a little bit, but, you know, they've never missed a meal. They've always had a decent place to live. They've always had clothing and always had health and health care and braces on their teeth. Whatever they needed, they've always had it. So I drink. So what? I need to drink. I need to take a drink after a hard day at the office. After a hard hour at the office. And I really was sincere when I said that. And he said, have you ever thought of quitting? I said, yeah, I have. As a matter of fact, I think about it all the time. In fact, I'm starting tomorrow. I am going to quit. And he said, have you ever thought of going to AA? And I said, thanks, but no thanks. I've already been to AA. And I had gone to a meeting a couple of years prior to that. And in Southern California, some of the meetings give chips. I don't know if they do that here or not. But at that meeting, they gave chips at the beginning of the meeting, right after the meeting started. And they said, the lead guy that was chairing the meeting said, is there anyone here that just finished their first 30 days of sobriety? If so, come up and get a chip and say a few words. And here comes this guy up, you know, gets his chip. My name's Joe Blow. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm really proud to get this chip. I know this is a spiritual program that I found God when I walked through the doors of AA. It's the lights in the eyes of the people that just turn me on and keep me coming back to these meetings. I just love everybody. Just before I came to the meeting tonight, I got a call from my employer, and he's made me general manager down at the plant. Just a wonderful, glorious life, and for all you newcomers, keep coming back. We love you. And I thought, my God, what is this? You know, just, geez. And anyone else? And here comes this little lady running up. My name's Mary Smith, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm very proud to get this chip, and I know this is a spiritual program that I found God when I walked through the doors of AA. It's the lights in the eyes of the people that just turn me on and keep me coming back to these meetings, and I just love everybody. You know, hate is no longer a word in my vocabulary. I just love everybody. You know, not just the members of AA, but everybody in the whole world. Short time ago, my children, when they looked my way, they had a look of fear in their eyes. Now when our eyes meet, there's a look of respect. And I've noticed lately that my husband is looking at me with renewed interest. And it's just a wonderful, glorious way of life. My children were failing in school. Now we're getting letters from all the major universities throughout the United States, offering free scholarships. It's a wonderful, glorious way of life here. And I wake up in the morning and I reach over, grab the hand of God, and we walk through the day hand in hand together. And for all you newcomers, keep coming back. We love you. I just couldn't handle it. No. I just couldn't. It just made my skin crawl. I just, and I wasn't able to attend the whole meeting. I needed a drink. And I went out and got one. Or 20. And so this guy said, hey, I said, forget it. It's some kind of a spiritual, I don't know, it's a religious cult of some kind. I don't know what it is. I said, all I know is I'm not interested. It's okay if they want to go to it. It's okay by me, but nothing I'd be interested in. And I said, I read an article about some stuff called anabuse, and I think I'll get a hold of that, some of that stuff. And because I am going to quit. I'm just tired of listening to her talk about my drinking, you know. And she drinks too, you know. And she's a bad drunk, and she shouldn't even drink. Some people just shouldn't drink, and she's one of them. So he put me in touch with this doctor, and I was going to get anabuse. And I was told by the receptionist, don't drink for at least 48 hours prior to coming to the appointment. Because, you know, according to this article I read about it, if you drink on top of anabuse, you can get deathly ill. In fact, people have died drinking on top of anabuse, according to this article I read. And so I didn't drink for 48 hours. And I came to the appointment, and the doctor says, first thing he asked me, is it true you haven't had a drink for 48 hours prior to coming here? I said, that's right. He said, you don't need anabuse. He said, anybody can go two full days, 48 hours, without a drink. You'd never take another drink as long as you live if you don't want to. Scared the hell out of me. I wanted to quit, but I wasn't quite prepared to quit that long at that time. And he just went on and on and on about the disease of alcoholism. How people that have the disease of alcoholism have character defects. They absolutely refuse to work on their defects. Instead of working on their defects, instead of coping with their problems, they drink tonight instead. And they wake up the next morning, and they still got all their defects and character and problems, only now they got a hangover on top of it. And they continue to do this over and over and over again. This guy was telling me my story. I didn't recognize it, but he was telling my story to me. And I says, well, okay, Doc. I says, if you're not going to give me anabuse, then I guess I better. How much do I owe you? And he says, I can see I'm not making much of an impression on you. But due to the nature of your appointment here today, I'm going to tell you something I wouldn't normally tell my patients. But he says, I'm going to tell you. He says, my wife's an alcoholic. He says, we've tried everything known to medical science, and nothing has helped her. We've tried psychiatrists. We've tried doctors. We've tried, you know, hospitalization. We've tried religion. We've tried everything. Nothing has helped her alcoholism. But she's sober now. She's in AA. She's sober for 7 months. Right now, she hasn't had a drink for 7 months. And he says, you look to be in good health. This is what I recommend that you do. Just go to the Manhattan Beach Clubhouse and buy the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Get a meeting schedule and start going to AA meetings. And and he says, and by the way, there'll be no charge for this call. And that's the only thing that guy said that day that impressed me at all. But I did go by the clubhouse and buy the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and picked up a meeting schedule. I brought it back to where we were living and threw it on my dresser and had another drink. Crazy doctor, you know. And then after that, this fiasco happened where she tried to commit suicide. And she had been with me and heard all of what the doctor had said. She went back to that doctor and asked him if he thought she was an alcoholic. And he said he didn't know for sure. But why didn't she go to some meetings with his wife? She'd be happy to take her. And that's what happened. And my wife started going to AA meetings. And I was leery, you know. Geez, be careful, you know. Whatever you do, be careful. And you know, we're not really married anymore. You know, we're divorced. And so if they ask if you got a husband, no, you know. Don't give them my name, whatever you do. I don't want anybody knocking on my door trying to convert me, you know. And she went to meetings, and that's the reason I'm standing up here this morning, because she went to AA. And I don't know if I'd have ever gone back. Maybe I would have. Who knows? But I start going to those meetings with her to be a good guy. And I realized that I was an alcoholic. But I hated AA. You know? And I thought the guys that stood up here were paid lecturers, you know, experts in their field, I thought. And you know what an expert is, don't you? An expert's a guy that knows 100 different ways of making love and doesn't even have a girlfriend. You know, they go to school and they get degrees in alcoholism treatment and all this stuff. And, you know, and they're well-meaning good people. I'm not putting them down, you know. But I can't listen to those guys, you know. I don't think they know what a drink does for a guy like me. You know, I know it's not healthy for me to be drinking. I know I'm in a little trouble with it. But, you know, I just can't listen to those guys, because I don't think they know what a drink does for a guy like me. You know, it's instant relief for me. I need a drink, you know. I just didn't listen to the people talking here. And you know what? I still feel that way pretty much about those people. And I know they're well-meaning people, and they work hard for us and all that. But, see, I can't get sober listening to those people. I turn them off. And for me, it's one amateur sharing with another amateur. It's one alcoholic sharing with another alcoholic. That's what got me sober. But I went to these meetings and drank, and my wife's sponsor said, you know, there's a guy speaking at a clubhouse. It's an anniversary, a 10th anniversary of the meeting or something like that, on Sunday afternoon. And it was during football season. And I didn't want to go because, you know, football was on TV. And so anyhow, but I got talked into it. And this guy Clancy was talking. And he gave this wonderful talk, and I laughed maybe for the first time in a long time at his antics, you know. He jumped over the Texas State Insane Asylum wall and ran through the Texas plains in his terry cloth robe and all that kind of stuff. It's just really funny stuff, you know. But about the time he was ready to quit his talk, he says, you know, he had about 11 years of sobriety then. And he said, of all the things that I've done, both drunk and sober, he says, I've been able to make amends, and I've been able to get forgiveness for. But he said, I'm still having trouble with the things I haven't done, the things I should have done, the sins of omission. And I sat there, and it hit me. You know, that's me. I hadn't been identifying with any of the speakers at all, because I had never done any of that bad stuff, you know. But I just, you know, I got to thinking at the meeting, and I should have been a better son. I should have been a better husband. I should have been a better father. Should have been a better employee. I should have. And I couldn't handle it. I don't know about you, but I can't handle the truth about myself. I can just barely handle the truth about you. Yeah. But don't tell me the truth about me. Whatever you do, I can't handle it. And I'm not ready to deal with it, and don't tell me, you know. And I could hardly wait for that meeting to be over, and so that I could go drink, because I can't handle the truth. And I did. As soon as that meeting was over, I went and drank. And I ended up, one time though, I finally quit drinking. I better get around to that. You might think I'm still drinking. I finally quit. And I started going to meetings on my own. And I kind of came out of it after a couple of weeks of not drinking. I was in some kind of an alcoholic fog or something. And I kind of came to at a meeting, kinda, you know. And I realized that I had just completed 30 years of drinking. And I've got this rotten wife. I've got two of the worst kids you could possibly imagine. I've got this pressure job. I owe money to everybody. It's all past due. And not last Friday. I mean past, in the past, way in the past. And they're after me. You know. And now I can't even drink. What am I going to do? What am I going to do with the rest of my life? Nothing. That's what I'm going to do. There's nothing to do when you don't drink. I hear all your stories and how wonderful it is. You know, who the hell do they think they're kidding anyhow? You know, it's not good when you don't drink. See, booze is a social lubricant for me. It enabled me to dance and romance and do all the things that normal people seem to be able to do without that stuff. My life's over. You know, it's over. I'm struck down in the prime of my life with a killer disease, you know. So I can't even go to a decent restaurant. You know. Can't go to a nice restaurant where they serve booze. You know. I'm stuck at Denny's for the rest of my life. What happens when you go into a nice restaurant? First thing they want to know when you go into a nice restaurant is, would you like a cocktail before dinner? And you can't say to them, well, yeah, I'd like one, but you see, I've got this disease. It's of a twofold nature. It's an allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. If I take even one drink, I can't predict my behavior. You know, if it wasn't for that, I'd sure have one. I used to think you had to explain all that stuff to people. And if I was standing on a street corner and somebody walked up, I'd start explaining what I was doing there. I had no self-worth at all. I just explained my life away, you know. And And that's one of the things I'm working on now in AA, is not to explain. I don't know if there's any explainers out there this morning or not, but I go 2 or 3 days sometimes without explaining anything. But invariably I catch myself and I'm explaining something to somebody. You know, I always start from the day I was born. I bring you up to date, you know, all the ramifications and all the, you know, everything, you know. I want you to understand. And then I realize what I'm doing. You know, hey, you're explaining it, I say to myself. And I stop right in mid-explanation. And, like, if there's any explainers out there this morning, I got bad news for you. They never, ever notice the difference. Turns out no one is listening to your explanation. No one gives a damn whether you, you know, want to know why you haven't done something you were supposed to do in the first place. They're just not interested. And I'm trying to quit over altogether. But it isn't easy. So, you know, our AA life started, and people were putting the pressure on me. I'd go to a meeting every night, but a different one every night. I never went back to the same meeting. They weren't up to my standards, I guess. I don't know. And finally, some people putting the pressure on me to get a sponsor. And so I asked Clancy to be my sponsor. And he said he would be, but provided I meet certain criteria. That is, he wanted me to go to a couple of the meetings that he went to. Because he wanted me to call him every day, but he wanted to see me too. So he wanted me to go to these meetings. And so I started going to this meeting called the Pacific Group in Los Angeles. That time it was a big meeting. It was about 250 people. But now that meeting has grown to between 1,000 and 1,500 people go to that meeting every Wednesday night. It's supposed to be the largest meeting in the world that meets on a regular basis. You can't prove it by me. That's what Clancy said. He's my sponsor. But I went to that meeting, and it's an hour and a half meeting. The format of that meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, a coffee break, and a main speaker. Now, they pick the 10-minute speakers on the way in. And you never know when you're going to be tagged. You know, you just walk in there, and about the second or third time I went to that meeting, the guy said, "Hank, you're the second 10-minute speaker tonight." And I said, "Wait a minute." I said, "I'm new." And he said, "That's okay." He said, "It doesn't matter." You know, I said, "Well, yeah, it does. I said, I just had the worst day of my entire life today. I said, there's nothing I could possibly share with anybody." He said, "That's okay, just get up there and tell your..." You know. I said, "You don't seem to understand." I said, he said, "What are you saying, you pass?" I said, "That's it, I pass." Yeah. "Catch me in about 6 months, I'll be happy to do it." Yeah. He says, "We don't pass at this meeting." He says, "When we're asked to do something at this meeting, we consider it an AA request. And you never, ever turn down an AA request." I said, "Well, that's fine." I said, "Well, I don't know what to say. I don't know what to tell you." And he said, "Oh, well, why don't you just go in and enjoy yourself, enjoy the meeting." He says, "Maybe next week you can find another meeting." He said, "If you don't want to participate at this meeting, this is, you know, it looks like it's fun and games, but this is serious stuff. This is life-saving stuff. And when you're asked to do something, and you turn it down, you know, this is, you know, you're not participating in recovery at all." And he says, "You know, so next week you can just go to another meeting where you can be a spectator." And, you know, I have found that to be true. I've been to meetings that the place is full of spectators. And there's only one or two people doing anything. And, yeah, you know, and sometimes I hear people get asked to read how it works or something. I don't read. I mean, you know, stuff like, well, we don't give a damn whether you read or not. Do it anyhow, you know. I mean, start participating in your recovery. And this isn't a popularity contest or any kind of anything like that. This is deadly serious business, only we laugh about it. We have a good time doing it. And so I said, oh, all right, I'll talk. Jeez, you know. So the first 10-minute speaker, he could have been a two-headed man for all I know. I was just so self-obsessed. Had I known I was going to be a 10-minute speaker a week or two ahead of time, I could have read the book. I could have... You know, I could have gleamed some of those great lines in there. You know, I could have laid them on you, you know. But I could have written them down on my cuff or something, you know, and give them to you, you know. But I didn't have time. And all of a sudden they call my name. Jeez, you know. And I got up and I just didn't have time to prepare a talk, so all I could do is tell the truth. And I got up there and I said, my name's Hank Johnson, I'm an alcoholic. And I said, I hate AA. I said, I've been sober for about 6 months now, and I said, I hate it. And I said, my life, instead of getting better like all you people, all your lives are getting better. Mine's going down the tubes. Everything is bad. My wife and kids and bills and my job, everything. It's worse now than it ever has been in my entire life. And I just went on and on and on like that for 10 minutes. And then I stopped, and they all clapped, you know. And then they had a coffee break, waiting for the main speaker. And that's when the miracle of AA happened for me. Because about 250 people, you know, I got unconditional acceptance from 250 people. It was overwhelming. You know, unconditional love, I could feel it from 250 people. They know exactly where I was. You know, they knew. And I just felt the power of AA in my life right then. And from that moment until this morning, I don't think I've ever turned down an AA request. And I'm not aware of ever doing it. As a result, I've had a good life. And things weren't always good right at first. You know, they're bad, right, actually. And things got better. And I remember calling Clancy up one Monday morning. It was about 10 o'clock in the morning. And I said, you know, I said, I'm just not going to be able to go to all these meetings you want me to go to. I said, I've decided I'm going to go back to therapy. Only this time I'm going to get a psychiatrist, MD psychiatrist. I'm going to check him out and make sure he knows something about, you know, about alcoholism and all anything. I'm going to find out once and for all what's wrong with me. It isn't. I don't really think it's alcoholism, but I've got some real deep, dark psychological problems. And so I've decided I'm gonna do that, and if I have to go every day, I will, you know. And he says, where are you? And I said, I'm at home. He said, well, it's 10 o'clock in the morning. So I've already been to work for over an hour. You know? He says, there's nothing psychologically wrong with you this morning. You're just not where you're supposed to be right now, that's all. And you have some anxiety about it. He says, get dressed and go to work. And he says, and you'll be a little bit embarrassed when you get there for being late, but you'll get over that in a few minutes and then call me. And, you know, he was right. You know, I went to work and I was a little embarrassed, and I sat down at my desk, everything was okay, and I called him and told him, you're right, I feel better. You know, and it turns out I don't have any deep, dark psychological problems. I'm just lazy. I don't want to do this stuff. I don't want to do the work that you want me to do around here. I don't want to participate. You know, I don't want to do the steps. I want you to do them for me and give me a short version of them or something, you know. And if I want you to love me, though, you know, while I do nothing, you know. And that's the way I am. And I have got forced into doing every damn thing I've ever done in AA. I've been forced into doing it, the first few years especially. You know. And, you know, I told them, I don't want to go to this meeting. I don't care if you want to go to the meeting. You go to it anyhow. You don't have to feel like it. Doesn't matter. You just go to your meeting. You know, if it's meeting night, you go to your meeting. There's no debate about it. You feel good or you feel bad, you still go. And if it's meeting night, so... You know, that's what happened. I took my steps. I took my fourth and fifth steps and sixth and seventh, and I was on my eighth step, and some guy walked up to me, and he said, you know, Hank, some of us spent money just like we drank, completely out of control. You know, and I thought, this guy, you know, how's he coming? How does he know that about me? You know, and he says, few of us are going to meet over at my house on Monday night. He said, we're going to take a fearless, moral, financial inventory of ourselves. And I said, well, you know, I don't know, you know. I said, that's not really AA, you know. And he says, you're sure welcome to come. And he said, if you decide to come, bring all your bills. And bring your checkbook and your pay stubs. I didn't want to bring my pay stubs. I didn't want you to know how much I really made, you know. I was wearing tailor-made suits back then. No shorts, but a tailor-made suit. And I looked good, you know. And, but I did it. And I went over there. And I had I had two drawers full of bills. I'd get a bill, and if I wasn't familiar with it, I'd just throw it in the drawer, you know. And I had all these bills, and I went over to Byron's house, and if you would have stacked them up on top of one another, I would have had about 3 feet of bills, you know. And before I left that night, without ever paying a bill, I reduced my indebtedness by 2/3. Because, see what I did? We threw away the duplicates. We threw away the triplicates. And, you know, it got to be a pretty small, much smaller stack of bills. And then we listed them, you know. And it wasn't quite as impossible as I thought. And you see, that's been my experience in AA and in my life, is I carry this stuff around in my head. And it gets bills and bills and bills to where it drives me nuts, you know. But as soon as I put it down on paper, it gets down to a manageable size with help, you know, with help from my sponsors and other people in AA. And so we wrote all my creditors. Said, I fully acknowledge that I owe you this money. However, I'm unable to pay as previously agreed upon. Please accept a check for $10. And I'll be sending you $10 a month until my financial picture changes. And so by return mail, almost, sometimes by telegram, unacceptable, send full amount or legal action will be taken. But none of them ever took any legal action. They all took the checks, you know. Every single one of them took the check. And it took me 3 years to get current in my bills. I don't mean paid off. I mean, current in my bills. But that was a big, big day for me in sobriety, to be caught up. I could walk down the street. I could meet anybody. If I saw you coming, I didn't have to cross the street. I could meet anyone head on. Because, you see, if I did owe you money, it was current. My wife and I went on with AA and And we moved up to the desert north of Los Angeles. We were going to end up retiring there. And she came to my office one day and said, I just got word from the doctor. I got lung cancer, and I've got 90 days to live. We had about 10, 11 years of sobriety or something like that at the time. We both had the same length of sobriety. And she didn't hear the part about the pills. You know, some guy came up to me one day at a meeting and said, Hank, I don't want to discourage you or anything, but, you know, your wife seems to be getting this program a hell of a lot better than you. And it turned out, no wonder. She was taking Valium at the time, you know. And she could handle anything, you know. So her sponsor finally got her to get off the pills, too. And she changed her sobriety date. So we had the same amount of sobriety. But when she gave me that news, I thought, Jesus, you know, what is the use of planning? You know, nothing's going to turn out okay. Just, you know, I was really discouraged, and it really was an imposition to me that she was sick. And I'm not proud of that, but that's how I felt about it. You know, just when things are starting to go good, now she's getting sick. I went to my meeting that night because I've been trained. You go to your meeting. You know, if it's meeting night, whether you feel like it or not, you go to your meeting, that's all. And so I did. And I'm driving over there that night. I thought, you know, you say you've worked all these steps. And I said, but you really haven't, or you'd be feeling better, you know. You just talk a good AA program. You're really not, you know, you're not really a good AA person. And I went to this meeting, and it was just a regular meeting there, and no big deal. But at the end of it, in Southern California, a lot of times, I don't know if they do it here or not, they read on page 164 of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, ask in your morning meditation what you can do for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. Then it goes on to say, you know, obviously you can't transmit something you haven't got. And I've heard that read hundreds of times. I've read it hundreds of times. But it had a big impact on me that night. And I walked out of that meeting that night, and I said, you know, our house is in order. You know, I had long since paid off all those bills. I had become responsible. You know, I had become dependable. I had good group insurance for my wife's medical. You know, I things were okay. You know, sure, hell, bad things happen to everybody. What makes me think that bad things shouldn't happen in my life or my wife's life? You know, and so I knew I was going to be able to be of some help to her, and I was. And she lasted 5 years. She lived for 5 years, and when she died, January of 86. She had 16 years of sobriety, and she died. And the damn shame, she had to go. And then you get to thinking, you know, about God's will. You know, I don't know if God wanted her to get cancer. I think she just smoked too many cigarettes, that's all. But, you know, I wrestled with what God's will is for me, you know, and all that stuff. I've just got to put all that aside and just accept, you know. I just accept life. And she died. I was glad that I at least, and I was sorry she was that she died, but I was at least I was glad that I was been able to be of some help to her. And I was glad that everything that needed to be said had long been said. And everything that needed to be done had long been done, and all you know, we were current in all our affairs. And so, you know, what do you do then? You know, I was married to her for like 38 years or something, you know. And what do I do now? My life is over again. I just didn't know what to do. So naturally what happened was the people in AA, both the men and the women, pulled me back into the world of the living. And I got to going to meetings, and more meetings than I had been going to, and a respectable time went by. I don't know, 5-6 months or 3 or 4, I can't remember. But seems like, you know, ladies in AA, they just want to fix you up all the time. Have we got a girl for you, you know? And please don't, you know, I don't know what it is about the women, you know. They just can't stand to see anybody happy, you know. They want you to be married too. And but anyway, I used to come home and think, why don't you call that lady that was at the meeting tonight? Why don't you call her? I'd say to myself, you know. Well, if you call, what? Why call her? She's not going to want to go out with you. Well, why not? You know, well, because, you know, and have this argument with myself. Well, just call her. I'd call. You want to go out Saturday night? Sure. Oh, Jesus. Now what am I going to do? You know? I don't know anything about relationships. I've been married all my life. And so but all the feelings came back to me. All those feelings I had when I was 16 and 17, 18 years old. All those feelings of fear and inadequacy and all those things, you know, about the opposite sex, all came back to me. You know. And maybe they want me to dance, for God's sake. I can't dance. You know. And all those feelings came back. And I remembered why I drank in the first place. But I bound and determined I'd get through this time without drinking. And I did. And I met, I was asked to talk in North Carolina at a little convention there. And I met a lady there that I had met up in Wisconsin about 8 years prior to that. She got sober in a group that a guy that I got sober with in Los Angeles, he went back to Wisconsin and started a group, and she got sober in that group, and we knew, had a lot of people in common, all this, and one thing led to another, and I finally said, you know, if I ever get back to Charlotte, I'll give you a ring, and maybe we can go out to dinner. She said it'd be fine. So I was pretty close one time, about 1,200 miles away. and I called her. And I asked her if she, you know, about coming down there. And anyhow, make a long story short, I now live in Charlotte, North Carolina. And 2 years ago, we got married. And we got to go to Paris. We got to go to London. We had a wonderful thing going. And you see, what happened to me is I wasn't looking for a relationship to fix me. You know, I've already been fixed. AA's fixed me, you know. And I don't need anybody to make me whole. I'm already whole. And I don't need to have another sick relationship like I did with my first wife. And we went through years and years of real sick stuff. And I don't need that anymore. And she didn't need it either. And so we ended up getting married, and we've got a good life going. And there's a big difference in age, however. And my sponsor told me, he says, "Well, if she dies, she dies. Go ahead." And I'm really glad to be here this morning. You know, AA has been the best thing that ever happened to me in my life, because I got sober going to AA. A lot of people get sober and then go to AA. I went to sober AA drunk and got sober, and then AA kicked in. And I'm very grateful, because sobriety has replaced all those feelings that I had, you know, that I had to drink. You know, drinking, alcohol was the focal point of my life over 30 years. And now sobriety is the focal point of my life. You know, it's the very center, very core of my being is sobriety. I don't mean just being sober. I mean sobriety and all it stands for here in AA. And everything I do stems out of that sobriety. And I'm living good. I'm living good. AA is good. My son used to look at me real funny way back in those days. He turned himself into AA when he was 21 years old. And he's celebrating in May the 27th, he'll celebrate 24 years of sobriety. And he's a very successful businessman. He makes too much money for a kid his age, you know. I never made anywhere near the amount of money he's made. And my daughter's kids, they're grown. And my grandson, 28 years old, he's got 10 years of sobriety. And we're an AA family. You know? We weren't any kind of a family 26 years ago. And we're still not the best family on the block. I wouldn't want to kid anybody. But we've got sobriety. We've got the program. And sometimes we all get together, like at a Thanksgiving or something. We're sitting across the table from one another and actually conversing and speaking to one another in civil language. You know? It's a miracle. You know? And we used to all be in the same house, but be all in the different rooms, you know. But now we can actually sit down and talk like we're real people or something. You know? And I'm very grateful to AA. I'm very grateful for sponsorship. And we started this group in North Carolina called the Southern Pacific Group. It's kind of an original thing. And we have a format there on speaker night. We have 2 10-minute speakers, a coffee break, and a main speaker, hour and a half meeting. And sometimes, some of those 10-minute speakers, you know, we ask them, do you want to be a 10-minute speaker tonight? You know, you're the second 10-minute speaker. I just couldn't do that. I'm new, you know. And I tell them, well, why don't you just go in and sit down and enjoy the meeting, and maybe next week you just go to another meeting. Some place where you can be a spectator. And, oh, all right, I'll talk. And so, about the only thing I absolutely for sure know about AA is that there are no experts here. We all have, there's a room here of 500 people or whatever, and we all got different views on, on the same subject. But the one thing that I absolutely know for sure is that this is a spiritual program. This is a spiritual program. And I know that I found God when I walked through the doors of AA. And you know, it's the lights in the eyes of the people that just turn me on and keep me coming back. Thank you very much.